Larry, I'm an addict. I think we should give Tom a hand for that, H&I. He's doing a hell of a job. And real quick, before I introduce Brownie, I'd like to share that I've been a volunteer, and I've been to that prison. And to see the hope and the desperation in those guys' eyes, and they'd love to see you come in there. So if you get a chance, if Tom or Glenn or Bill or any of them guys ask you to go, you should do it, man, because it does something to me. It's really awesome. So thanks again, Tom. I thought that was really great. Brownie, I met this guy, it's 8 years ago. Kobe and I went to New York City to a convention. And I said, Kobe, how are we going to get, where are we going to stay? And he says, well, I'm going to stay at this guy's house named Brownie. And I said, okay. And we get off the airplane, and I see this guy walking down the hallway. I said, oh, my God, he's high right now. And, he was all wild looking, and I said, this is all right, Kobe? He goes, yeah, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. Tony D sent him. It'll be cool. So I said, fuck, he looks like he just came out from under a bridge. And then later on, when I met him and learned him, he did come out from under a bridge. But you know what, man, this guy has really touched my life. He stopped his life for 4 days, took Kobe and I all over New York City. And I don't know if you've ever been to a strange city and not knew anybody there. Maybe you've been to a convention and you have to take a taxi everywhere. This guy showed us New York City in 4 days. He took us everywhere. He made us speak at every group we went to. We went to Ground Zero. We went to Times Square. I mean, the whole city, everywhere. And, it was really great, you know. And, I don't know, over the years, Brownie and I we had a connection somehow. And he ended up letting us stay at his house. And, I mean, we crashed at his house. And so, before, when I was using, if I met somebody like that and they let me crash at their house, I would have stole everything they had. And, this guy took us in. I mean, like nothing. So I didn't take too much, just a few little things. Whatever I could get in my suitcase. But you know what, man? This guy, we've really built a great relationship with this guy. And he's became my traveling partner. He's became my friend in NA. He is truly all about Narcotics Anonymous. He lives, breathes. He's all about the traditions, the steps. And this guy has came, I know he's came from a lot of us, he's came from the bottom of the barrel, and he's worked and scratched and clawed his way up to the top. And I'm really proud of him, and I love you, Brownie. Come on up, tell your story.
Yeah, I'm Brownie, I'm an addict. Can you guys hear me? You can hear me, right? I just want to say to Larry, after that introduction, you'll never stay in my fucking house again as long as you're... You know, I want to congratulate the members of the Mocan Area Convention Committee of Narcotics Anonymous for their dedication and their selfless service in providing a venue to fulfill our primary purpose, which is to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. I was involved with my home area, which is the Western Queens area of Narcotics Anonymous, with our first convention. We just had it. It was March 7th, 8th, and 9th of last month. And it was a commitment when I took it. I thought it was going to be a one-year commitment. It turned out to be a four-year commitment. And I know the sacrifice, the dedication, the perseverance, and just the compassion that you have to have for a sick and suffering addict to be involved in something like that. So, I want to commend the members that did this convention for having all those principles in their life. And I want to congratulate you guys. And listen, I'm a grateful addict. I'm very, very grateful. My life has been a miracle since I walked into Narcotics Anonymous. I'm excited about being clean. Being clean is exciting to me. And I'm enthusiastic about it. And I try and be enthusiastic about my recovery because I feel that enthusiasm is the purest form of gratitude and that it's contagious to the newcomer. There's nothing that makes me more depressed or sick than when I walk into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and the members look like they've been sentenced to the fucking meeting. Yeah. I wonder what does the newcomer think? I'm enthusiastic about it. For lack of a better way to say it, I'm down with this shit. I'm all in. I'm an Narcotics Anonymous member. And I want to thank Jimmy Kinnon. I hear sometimes, I go to meetings, I hear everybody throw all these circuit speakers' names around. I don't give a fuck about any of them. I want to thank the guy that took the time and used his house to get this fellowship going. I want to thank those members in Sun Valley that adapted the 12 steps, not adopted them, adapted them so that they worked for hopeless addicts like myself. Because I'm going to tell you, there was no way out before there was an Narcotics Anonymous. And I used drugs for what seemed to be a lifetime in the streets of New York City. And I can remember as a young boy wanting to be clean. I went to high school in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. That probably means nothing to some of you. Some of you have probably heard of it. The best way I could describe it is there's a lot of heroin in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. And I became primarily a heroin addict as a young boy. And I don't... And I just say that because it's my story. I don't want anybody to eliminate themselves because they didn't use the same substance as I did. This is a fellowship that we have one common bond, the disease of addiction. And it's not about the substance that I used. I want to tell you this, that I didn't refuse any drugs. I wasn't a refuser of drugs. When I was on the methadone maintenance treatment program, a guy came up to me with a mayonnaise jar full of pills. He said, "Brownie, do you know what these pills are?" I said, "Give me 10, I'll let you know in a half an hour." I was very open-minded when it came to drug use. And I talk about the drugs. I go into Narcotics, I don't know where the fuck that came from, that we don't talk about drugs. This is our fellowship. This is a fellowship of drug addicts. So I talk about the drugs in Narcotics Anonymous. When I am asked, when I'm given the privilege to carry the message to an addict that still suffers, I put my crosshairs and my telescope squarely on the forehead of the newcomer. I try and talk straight to the newcomer. And I don't know where that came from, that we don't talk about drugs in Narcotics Anonymous. There's another fellowship that used to throw you out for that. This isn't it. This isn't. And I'm going to read you something from our third tradition. We have a pamphlet called the group pamphlet. And in there it says that we need not dwell excessively on war stories. It says dwell excessively. Doesn't mean don't talk about where you came from and what happened to you. Yeah, I'm going to read something from our third tradition. It says, although our third tradition is written simply, we know that when it talks about a desire to stop using, it means using drugs. We understand that Narcotics Anonymous is a program of recovery for drug addicts. Thank God for that. Although addiction takes on a broader meaning for many of us as we continue in recovery, and it has for me, it's important to remember that we first came to Narcotics Anonymous because of our drug problem. If new members, and there we are, back to the newcomer again, are to feel that they belong in Narcotics Anonymous, they need to hear something they can identify with. They find that identification in the fellowship of recovering addicts in Narcotics Anonymous. And I go into meetings now and people tell you that you can't curse. This is a spiritual program. It's okay to say fuck here. Yeah. I'm going to share my experience. When I walked into my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, the guy was talking about heroin and he said fuck. I remember thinking, this guy knows what he's talking about. So I try not to get into the arrogance that I've moved so far in recovery that I shoot over the head of the newcomer. I try and keep the newcomer in mind when I carry the message. Because this message is a precious gift. It's a miracle. It's something that I don't want, that I've been given. I've been given a precious gift, and I don't want it to go over the head of the person that I'm supposed to be giving it to. And here, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story. I was a hopeless drug addict. Basically, I told you my choice of drug was. And I can remember wanting to be clean as a young boy. And I can remember looking for a way to get clean, and there was no way to get clean. And I remember, going to all kinds of different treatment programs. And I started to realize that society was more baffled about what was wrong with me than I was. I remember one time I had gotten arrested. They let me out of, they released me to an outpatient drug program. They always send you outpatient, 5 times a week, outpatient. This way you never get into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. You're so busy going to outpatient that they're guaranteed to get you back so they can charge your insurance again. Yeah. So I was going to outpatient. And on my way out of the outpatient program, there was a little Korean doctor standing by the door. And he said to me, Mr. Brown, he said, we have no treatment for heroin addiction. He said, you look like an excellent candidate for such treatment. So I said to him, well, what is it? He said, we call acupuncture. So I said to him, now, I had been through all kinds of treatment, and I had no faith in any kind of treatment. Here was my question. Do you accept Medicaid? That was my question all the time, yeah. I wanted to know if they accepted Medicaid. So he said, he took me into his office, and believe me, I was hopeless, and I was desperate, and I wanted anything to work. I was willing to try anything. And the guy drilled a hole through the top of my ear, and he put a metal pin in my ear. And I'll never forget what he said to me, because I so desperately wanted it to be the truth, and I wanted it to work. He said to me, when urge to use heroin come over you, he said, spin the metal pin in ear. He said, stimulate production of endorphins in system, And he said, urge to use, go away. And I remember looking at him, and I remember thinking, this motherfucker looks like he knows what he's talking about. And I left his office. I left his office at 12 noon. At 12:30, I was in the shooting gallery on Pickens Avenue in East New York, Brooklyn, like this. And I remember the guy in the shooting gallery said to me, what the fuck is that thing in your ear? And I continued to use, and then he said to me, hey, you think you could get me one of them? Where'd you get that? So that was like my experience with all of these solutions. You know what? Literature is very specific about what works and what don't work. We read it at the beginning of every meeting. We say, many of us ended up in jail. And I heard what the guys in jail said. I like the guy who said it was a fucking snake pit. I'll go with that one. Many of us ended up in jail. Medicine, religion, and psychiatry, none of these methods was sufficient for us. Now, we don't tell people they can't go to the psychiatrist or they can't go to church. We tell them these aren't solutions for the spiritual disease that we suffer from. And our first step is more specific about it. Our first step goes into it in a little more detail. We say psychiatrists, hospitals, recovery houses, new towns, new jobs, new lovers, everything we tried failed. So if I'm a Narcotics Anonymous member and I'm trying these solutions, that means I'm practicing the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Now, when I came to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, I had used drugs for what seemed to be a lifetime. And I'm going to tell you something. I was born in 1952. There was another fellowship in New York since 1933. I didn't know anybody that got clean. All my friends died from using heroin. It wasn't until 1981 that when Narcotics Anonymous came to New York that things began to change for addicts. So I was on the streets of New York City, and I'll tell you something. I looked like a junkie when I was using. Some people say that look still hasn't gone away. Yeah. Yeah. Fuck them. Right. But I was standing somewhere on the street in New York City, and Narcotics Anonymous, this was about maybe 1985, and Narcotics Anonymous was fairly new in New York City, and someone must have seen me and said, get a look at this guy, like, just push him in there, and I ended up inside a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And let me tell you something, I don't know how I got there, and I don't remember anything anybody said. I don't remember who the speaker was. I was high. I won't let anybody in this meeting know if you got high today that you're a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I'll let you know that. I'm going to go further into that. Here's what I'm going to tell you. That when I was using, I had a very, very busy schedule. I really did. Really. Between stealing, selling what I stole, sneaking on the subway with whatever I stole, trying to sell it to people that only wanted to give me $2 for it, going from cop spot to cop spot, trying to find one that was open, dodging the detectives, dodging the warrant squad, having no place to live, out in the winter in the freezing cold. Let me tell you something. If you made it, if you could squeeze a Narcotics Anonymous meeting into that schedule, far be it from me to be the motherfucker that don't welcome you here. You have to be in a terrible amount of pain to show up in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting under those circumstances. And I came, and I was high when I got to the meeting. And I don't remember what happened inside the meeting. But I remember this, that something interrupted my thinking process. And let me tell you something. I had I had used for what seemed to be a lifetime, and I had started to think a certain way, and most of my beliefs were steeped in self-deception and dishonesty, and I believed a lot of things that weren't true were true. And we say we had most of our information was we were misinformed people. We were misinformed by misinformed people. That was my case. And when I think back to the way I thought when I first got to Narcotics Anonymous, some of the things that I believed seem totally bizarre to me now. They really seem bizarre. I had a fucked up thinking process. One of the things that I believed was that if you had teeth, that you were the police. I believed that. I really thought that healthy people that had teeth, they must be the police. Yeah. And let me tell you something. In that first meeting, I seen people that looked happy. They looked healthy. I heard one guy say he was dressed nice. He had a gold chain around his neck. He said he hadn't used. He was a career heroin addict. He hadn't shot up in 4 years. And I remember thinking, I don't know about that. Because let me tell you something. The thought of not using was totally inconceivable to me. And I had a hard time believing when people said they... I can remember asking a guy outside the meeting, you mean you don't use nothing? How could that be? I didn't know anybody that didn't use nothing. I thought that was impossible. I thought the concept of total abstinence was the most bizarre fucking thing I ever heard in my entire life. And when I started to go to the meetings, they put an interruption in my thinking process, and I started attending Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And I wish I could tell you, that I've been clean ever since then. But here's what happened to me. I had been conditioned by society's solutions to believe that there was something wrong with me that no one understood and that could never be fixed. And I thought I suffered from a hopeless condition. There could never be a reprieve from what I suffered from. And I remembered that everyone who tried to treat me was looking for some kind of... Money seemed to be at the bottom of all the kinds of treatment. Listen, I remember I was living homeless in the Hunts Point section of the South Bronx. It's a notorious section of the South Bronx. I was living homeless there. And I had been using for about 25 years. And I used till my teeth fell out, till my hands were covered with sores. My pants were covered with blood from shooting up. And I can remember when the rush hour traffic coming out of Manhattan used to come right by where I was living underneath the highway there. And one guy stopped and he said to me, he was like a good Samaritan type. He said to me, look, buddy, you need fucking help. He said, if you're here tomorrow at this time, he said, I'll take you to a hospital. So the next day came by. I just happened to still be there. I wasn't waiting for him. Yeah. Just happened to still be there. He took me to a hospital in the Bronx. And I remember when I got to the hospital, I looked like I was shot out of a cannon. I had a full beard. My teeth were rotten out. By the way, I have an AIDS diagnosis for over 25 years. So I wasn't looking too spry and chipper when I wasn't eating and running around the street. And I remember when I got to the hospital, there was a guy. He was dressed in a suit. He had glasses on like this. He had a bunch of paperwork in front of him. I was standing there in front of him. I stunk. And I remember he was looking around on the paper, shuffling the paper. And he looked up at me and he said, what kind of insurance do you have? And I remember thinking, this guy just don't get it. I wanted to tell him, Lloyd's of London, motherfucker. Yeah. And it wasn't until I got to Narcotics Anonymous that I met people that didn't care what I had. They didn't give a shit what I had. And one of them first meetings, and I had that meeting list, I went to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I was always cold and tired and hungry and broke and lonely and desperate. And I just wanted to get out of what I was in, and I really didn't care how it stopped. And I can remember being very, very confused. And that feeling of hopelessness was embedded in the fiber of my being. And I can remember a guy pulled me out of my seat at one of them meetings, and he had a brown paper bag, and inside the brown paper bag he had a pound of ham, he had half a pound of Swiss cheese, and he had some rolls. And he took me out of my chair, and he brought me into the back of the meeting in the pantry of the church, and he made me a ham and Swiss cheese sandwich on a roll. And I ate the ham and Swiss cheese sandwich. He made himself one, too. And I ate the ham and Swiss cheese sandwich, and I started talking to him. And he started talking to me about the places he'd been, the things he'd done, the institutions he had been in, the drugs he used. And he told me what his life was like now in recovery. And for the first time, I got the feeling, for the first time in my life, that I had met someone who understood what was wrong with me. And you know, we say in Narcotics Anonymous that the spiritual essence of this program is one addict helping another. And that's what I'm here to talk about tonight. I'm talking about service work and reaching out to people. And I started coming to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and I came to meeting for about, must have been about 4 years before I got the balls up to stop using. No one ever told me I wasn't welcome in the meeting. People encouraged me. They said nice things to me. They helped me in whatever way they could. People welcomed me back when I showed up back. They were happy to see I was still alive. And I started coming, and back in the 80s, there was a lot of goodwill in the fellowship. There was more goodwill than there seems to be now. Now we have a lot more. The fellowship is anchored in a lot more literature. But back then, sometimes the only thing that stood between you and your next shot of dope was the addict sitting next to you in the meeting. So there was a lot of camaraderie in the meeting, and there was a lot of goodwill. And I had no place to live. And sometimes people would let me stay in their house. And unlike Larry, I would never steal anything out of anybody's house. I wanted to be welcomed back, yeah. You know. And I started coming to meetings, and I was using, and I started listening to what the members shared about using drugs, and the truth started to become apparent to me. I would go out and use and prove that what they said was the truth. And then I would come back into the meeting, and I started to develop the principle of self-honesty. And one guy had me sleeping in his boiler room. He had a bed in the boiler room in the basement of his building, and in the boiler room I had a TV set. And I had my first, like, awakening after I had a relapse, and I came back into that boiler room. The TV show, The Wheel of Fortune, was on the TV. And I had just used and listened to the people say what the truth was, and I came back to the guy's house, and I was down there, and a woman on the Wheel of Fortune won a cruise to the Caribbean. And I remember thinking, well, that's never happened to me. But I remember identifying with the Wheel of Fortune because I remember thinking, my life is like this TV show. Only the slots on the wheel say Rikers Island, detox, mental institution, rehab, multiple arrests, you know, emergency room. And when I pick up a shot or a drink or smoke some crack, I spin the wheel. And congratulations, Mr. Brown, You want a winter vacation in the South Bronx. You'll be touring the vacant lots, abandoned buildings, and shooting galleries of the scenic South Bronx while staying in your deluxe accommodations underneath the Bruckner Expressway. And Vanna, show Brownie what he's won. It's a brand new shopping cart. Yeah, so when I started to put it together, you know, we say here, know the truth and the truth will set you free. I heard that in the Narcotics Anonymous meeting. To thine own self be true. It's hard to deny our addiction when our problems are staring us in the face. So I started to develop that principle of self-honesty, and I started to realize I was able to look at a bag of heroin and see it for what it really was. And I started to move from fantasy to reality. I started breaking those barriers, clearing those barriers away, clearing those barriers of denial and self-deception and non-belief. They started getting cleared away. And it was through the people that practiced principles with me, that practiced spiritual principles with me, people that showed me empathy and concern and understanding and selfless and unconditional love, people that welcomed me back, people that met me where I was and loved me for what I was and saw hope for me when I saw no hope for myself. They're the ones that helped me get into recovery and change my life. And I think the miracle here happens in Narcotics Anonymous is when we practice these principles on each other and all our affairs. And I was able to stop using, put time between me and some drugs for short periods of time. And then, you know, listen, I've been coming here for 22 years. I'm not clean for 22 years. I stayed clean 1 year, 3 times. Then, in the course of getting the 1 year, twice I made it to 2 years. And here's what I want to share with the members who might be in the same place and the newcomers in the room. I want to let them know that when I look back at those periods of abstinence, because they were just periods of abstinence, I clearly see them as periods of abstinence now, but I then thought that I was in recovery. If you would have told me I wasn't in recovery during that period, I would have wanted to fucking fight with you. Yeah, I would have said, what do you mean I'm not in recovery? But here's what I noticed about those periods of abstinence. There was always a loophole in my program. You know, we, in the chapter in the basic text, Recovery and Relapse, there's a line in there that says, we've never seen a person who lives in Narcotics Anonymous program relapse. And we do recover, it says, in our experience, no addict who is completely surrendered to this program has ever failed to find recovery. That means that if I have a home group, a sponsor, I'm involved in 12-step work, I sponsor people, if I'm reading the literature, I'm involved in service, I make meetings, I make phone calls, and I use drugs, that means I'd be the first person. Listen, when I went to that Chinese guy and he told me to spend the pen in my ear, he didn't make me no fucking promises like that. And you know, we have a message here, a beautiful message in our character, a message of hope, a promise of freedom, that any addict, can stop using, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. That's what I found here in Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, there was a couple of years there where when I kept having those relapses, there was always a loophole in my program. I either didn't have a sponsor or I didn't walk the steps. It wasn't about what was going on in my life because my life was a catastrophe. You know, my life was a catastrophe. What I knew about living before I got to Narcotics Anonymous nearly killed me. And it was no different after the drugs were gone. What I knew about living continued to almost kill me after I got here. So I learned like this. I was clean 2 years for the second time. I had no sponsor. I wasn't working the steps. And I ended up using drugs again. I got arrested in Manhattan. In Manhattan, the jail, the city jail back then was called the Tombs. They sent me to the Tombs. I was waiting for Raymond, for Raymond in the Tombs in the bullpen with 30 other guys in the bullpen, waiting for Raymond. Now, in the years I had been an Alcoholics Anonymous member, I had learned to make simple observations. And we say a good recovery requires observation. We need to observe what works and what don't work. I made a simple observation in the bullpen. I observed that none of the other 30 guys in the bullpen had a sponsor or worked the steps neither. And I began to catch on like that. And you know what we say, when you do what you've always done, you get what you've always got. And our sixth step tells us that we know we're growing when we begin to make new mistakes instead of repeating the same ones that we've always been repeating over and over again. You know, and I used to come into the meeting and I would pick out the guy. I'd say, this guy, what do you mean I need a sponsor? This guy has 18 years. He's got no sponsor. He hasn't worked the steps. Well, I'm here to share this with you. Here's what I know about that guy today. He's not me. I can't do what he does. Relapse defined for me in clear and certain terms who I am as an addict and what I needed to do to stay clean. So I got a sponsor. I got involved with the 12 steps. I used the Narcotics Anonymous literature. 12, the Narcotics Anonymous step working guides. I hear people now, they call it the flat book. I don't call it the flat book because I don't want to eliminate Narcotics Anonymous from the title of the book. The guys who worked on the book, they named it the Narcotics Anonymous Step Working Guide. That's good enough for me. Yeah. I wasn't on the fucking committee. I'm the guy that lived under the highway in the South Bronx. And you know what? I attend Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And making meetings wasn't enough for me to stay clean. I had to surrender to the whole program. You know, we have a pamphlet that says, Welcome to the Narcotics Anonymous Program. In there, it says that, says you can get clean just by coming to meetings. But if you want to stay clean and be in recovery, you must be involved in the 12 steps. I'm here to share with you that I couldn't stay clean until I got involved in the 12 steps of this program. And the program works. What do we say? It works if you work it. It works if you don't work it. It probably just won't work for you. I hear that all the time in New York City. And I got involved in the program. And I started working steps. Now I sponsor people. I have a wonderful home group. My home group is a half a mile away. My home group is the day-by-day group. We meet in Woodside, Queens. A lot of these guys have been to my home group and spoke there. I've been a part of my home group. They know the members. There's people in this room tonight that have been to my home group. And my home group is like the driving passion in my life. It's really the place I love to be. It meets 5 days a week. We meet on Monday and Thursday from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., and we meet on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday from 12 noon to 1:30 p.m. And it's really it's very, very rich spiritually, my home group. In this way, that it's filled with desperate, fucked up people looking for a way to get clean. And I get to practice what I've been given here, and I get to practice what I've been taught by the members who came here before me. in that home group with those people. And you want to know something? We can only keep what we have in Narcotics Anonymous by giving it away. I'm all in. I'm down with that. I spent a lot of my time around the desperate ones. I love being around the sick members. I remember when I was sick, I used to feel like no one wanted to be around me. When I came to Narcotics Anonymous, I actually didn't know what to talk about. I can remember standing outside Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I had absolutely no social skills, and I couldn't carry on a conversation. I can remember being outside the meeting. I'd be in a circle of people, and they'd be talking. One guy would say, oh, I bought an air conditioner for my apartment. The next guy would say, I paid my car insurance. The next guy would say, I brought my girl to a Broadway play. The next guy would say, I visited my mother today. The conversation would get to me. I would say, remember the dope La Tuna on Clinton Street? Wasn't that dope good? Yeah. And I actually, of course, I was in a place where if you weren't talking about using or hustling or in the street or the police chasing you, I didn't know what to talk about. So I stay in my home group and I stay around those people. And I practice the 12 steps. You know, and listen, from being around my home group, it's a place where I get to see miracles occur on a daily basis. I have a couple of home group members that, there's one of the guys in my home group, he was in the AIDS hospice for 8 years, waiting to die. They were giving him methadone in the AIDS hospice. He came into my home group, they brought him there with the ambulette. He came out in the wheelchair, and he came to my home group for about a year, still on the methadone. We encouraged him. We welcomed him back. He got the courage to start going down on the methadone. He got off the methadone. He finally got off the methadone. Then the wheelchair went. He started coming with a walker. After he was about 6 months clean, he started coming on crutches. I see this guy every day. I get to witness the miraculous turnabout. Our basic text says this miraculous turnabout is evidence of a spiritual awakening. I get my spiritual awakening at my home group. Listen, I'm in the trenches. I roll up my sleeves and I get the fuck in there. And this guy now, not only isn't he in the hospice no more, he's living free in society. He has his own apartment. His crutches are gone. He comes in with a gym bag now. He comes from the gym. And I'll tell you what, I'm a little jealous of the fucking guy now. Yeah. He comes in with a fucking gym bag. So I've been, you know, my journey in recovery has been one, when I first got clean, I was after all the materialism, and I wanted a girlfriend. I'd never had a girlfriend. I wanted a girlfriend. I've been using. Listen, when you live under a highway, you have AIDS and no teeth, you don't have that many romantic relationships going on. Yeah. It's not a big issue. Yeah. So I got into recovery, and I got some teeth and all that. I can remember the guy said to me, get a sponsor. I said, I'm getting a girlfriend. Yeah. And let me tell you, I was a bad picker. My picker was fucking definitely broken. If you walked into the meeting and you were on methadone maintenance for 30 years and a girl had a couple of black eyes, one leg shorter than the other and some teeth missing, I said, that's my girl. That's, yeah. And my thinking was like this. I would look at him, and I would think like, did you ever see the TV show, The $6 Million Man? I would go like this. I could rebuild her. I could rebuild her. Yeah. Look, I have the technology. Yeah. Look, I moved one girl into my apartment. I went through the whole thing with the relationship. I had one. I moved her into my apartment. She was in. She was being released from an institution on the weekends. I was waiting outside the institution with my car. And then I would bring it to the Narcotics Anonymous meeting like it was the drive-in movie. I remember one of the old-timers in the meeting said to me, is that your girl there? I said, yeah. He said to me, isn't she in the institution? I said, yeah. Then he said to me, he said something I never forgot. And now, this goes for all the members, not just the woman. Because the women get a little touchy, you know. The men, this goes for the men too. He said to me, do you realize what you're doing is like shopping in the dented can aisle of the supermarket? And I remember what I said to him. I said, watch it, motherfucker, that's my girl. Yeah. So I moved her in. I had her in my apartment, right? She's living in my apartment. She had no sponsor, no steps. I had no spirituality. I wasn't spiritually grounded in any kind of recovery. You know, we just used to go to meetings together. Do your nails. Let's go to the meeting. Yeah. Get your hair done for the meeting. You know, I was gravitated towards material. So the girl that I thought was so beautiful, let me tell you something. If you're in a relationship and there's no spiritual principles in that relationship, you face a rough road. Really. Things are going to be a little edgy and irritable around the breakfast table. She would get up and she would be like this. And then I said, wow, the girl I thought was so beautiful, she's starting to look like a pit bull. Yeah. So I began to realize, hey, one night I was making love to her, she went like this. So I began to realize that no matter what I put in my life, without the principles of this program, acceptance, surrender, courage, trust, perseverance, humility, that no matter what came into my life, I wouldn't be able to manage it. It would drive me fucking nuts. So I'm involved in the program now. And I stay involved in the Narcotics Anonymous program. And I'm going to share a couple of stories with you that I haven't been in a romantic relationship in Narcotics Anonymous for 9 years and 8 months. And this is not by any coincidence. I'm clean 9 years and 8 months. I'm going to share that with you. Now I'm clean 9 years and 8 months. My relationship is with the 12-step working guide, service, my sponsees, you know, my home group. And let me tell you something. There's no fucking perfect members. I want to let the newcomers know this. That if you walk into a meeting and you meet someone that appears to be perfect, run for your fucking life. Well, hightail it the fuck out of there. There's nothing more creepy than that, you know. Really. But since I've been involved in all of this stuff, you know, my life has taken a course provided by my higher power. And if I would have been in control of my life over the last 9 years and 8 months, a lot of wonderful things that have happened to me wouldn't have happened to me. And I'm going to share a story with you. You know, I've been all over the world now, halfway around the world, with Narcotics Anonymous. And not just as a speaker. Everybody wants to be a fucking speaker. Speakity, 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 speakity. How about a nice big cup of shut the fuck up? Really. Really. Where's the girl who opened the convention? Her name was Holly. Is she in this room? She said something very important. She only spoke for about 5 minutes. She said something I really believe. You know what she said? She said, I'm not really into the speaking. I'm nervous. She said, but I come from the best fucking home group in the world. Let me tell you something about this message. The message is meaningless unless you live it. If I wasn't in my home group with my sleeves rolled up, if I wasn't in and out of Rikers Island, if I didn't go on an H&I commitment wherever I've traveled, what the fuck would I be talking about up here? A lot of shit about me, I guess. What I got, what I've accomplished. One thing I've learned in Narcotics Anonymous, the 12 steps have made me ease the pain and confusion of living life without drugs, but the 12 traditions taught me something crystal clear, that it's not about fucking me in this fellowship. Believe me, it's not about me. And I've been blessed with a lot of stuff. They asked me to be... Now, the reason why I said that about the speaking is because I don't want to be a fucking speaker. I want to be a Narcotics Anonymous member. I want to feel that feeling of being spiritually refreshed and glad to be alive because of the service work I've done with hopeless, desperate people. That's what I want to feel. I'm eager to help people that are in the pits of despair. It gives me that feeling. My purpose, my self-worth has been grounded in my higher power's purpose. And not just from the fucking podium. And let me tell you something about speaking. It's no more important than the guy out there at the registration desk, the people that back there selling the water, the guy who hugs you when you come into a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, the person that makes the coffee is probably more important than the people that speak, because that takes some fucking action, not just lip service. You know, but I've been blessed. And recently I was asked to go, I'm going to tell you like how my life has turned around and how God took a hopeless, desperate addict and just used me for something I never would have imagined that I would have been used for in a billion years. And if I would have pursued my own selfish interests, it never would have happened to me here. When I surrendered to the Narcotics Anonymous program, we say, when the addict stops using drugs, wonderful things happen. Miracles happen. So I was invited to Ireland. I was the banquet speaker at the Irish Regional Convention, which I really don't care that much about. But when I was in Ireland, my friend invited me to Belfast. He said, we're going into the prison in Belfast. He said, we're going to meet my friend Duff. We're going to take the train up. It's a 5-hour train ride. We're going to meet my friend Duff. He's going to take us into the prison, McGarvery Prison in Northern Ireland. And that's a maximum security prison. That's where they house the IRA, the terrorist groups and all of that. It's pretty well buttoned up when you go in there. So we took the train up there. The guy met us at the train station. He had a year and a half clean. His name was Duff. I guess that's short for Duffy, right? Said we're in Ireland, right? So he took us to the prison. Now, it was me, my friend Johnny Schertz from New Jersey, and my friend Paul O from Dublin. On the way from the train station to the prison, I said to him, are we going to go and do an H&I to these prisoners? He said, no. I said, well, then what the fuck are we doing? He said, we're going to talk to the warden and all the staff members of the prison. So I said to him, don't you have a public information committee? He said, I do now. So he said... Let me tell you something. It's better to be prepared than get prepared. You know what? All that work I had done, all that service I had been involved in, all of that familiarity with our 12 traditions and our 12 concepts, I was ready. I told him, let's go, motherfucker. Let's go in there. And he took us in. We went in. I was strip searched, mugshotted. This is a real, because there's terrorists in the prison. Fingerprinted, hand scanned at five different checkpoints. We get into the chapel of the prison, and inside the chapel of the prison is the warden, the drug task force correction officer, the captain, 10 correction officers, all his guys, all the drug counselors in the prison, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a doctor, a nurse and a nursing staff, and a priest and a nun. And we're sitting up in front. And I remember looking at them, and the thought went through my mind. I said, these are all the motherfuckers I hated before I got to Narcotics Anonymous. I really thought that. But we gave an H&I presentation because we had the experience. And let me tell you something. If I hadn't been involved in the steps and the traditions and the concepts, we gave a presentation for about 10 minutes each. Then they asked us questions about the fellowship. Most of them questions could be answered with our 12 concepts, our 12 traditions, or our 12 steps. That's how we answered most of those questions. And they all had questions. And the last guy to have his hand up was the warden of the prison. And it was my turn to pick. So I picked the warden. Now, this is one of the miracles that happened to me in Narcotics Anonymous. And if you're not involved, you don't see the miracles. You know, I couldn't believe what the fucking guy said. Here's what he said. He said, I've been the warden of this prison for 22 years. He said, the professionals in this room, he said, they don't want you guys in here. And you want to know something? I knew from all my experiences that he was telling the truth. And I knew why they didn't want us in here, because you can't profit monetarily from a spiritual program. Thank God for our eighth tradition, that we remain forever non-professional. Thank God that we freely and gratefully give that which was freely and gratefully given to us. A passion of love. Thank God it's like that here in Narcotics Anonymous. It's the only place I ever found that was like that, where actually I could come into the meeting and look around and say, some of these motherfuckers actually give a shit if I stay clean or not. Then the warden said something, the miracle happened. He said something I couldn't believe. And let me tell you something, I've been around a couple of wardens, they don't say shit like this. He said, when I was a kid, he said, I used alcohol and drugs. He said, I didn't like them. And he's saying this in front of his whole staff, but like this. Then he said, I didn't like the way they made me feel. He said, so I never used them again. He said, but after seeing and listening to you guys, he said, I almost want to use drugs, he said, so I could get clean and become a part of what you guys belong to. And guess what? Now, even though I had the concepts and the traditions and the steps behind me, I couldn't resist. I said, Warden, I said, I'm going to give you my phone number. If you get fucked up, you can call me anytime. Now, I got a phone call from Belfast from Duff. Duff was at our convention. You met him, right, Kobe? I think Larry met him. Duff tells me that the Narcotics Anonymous meeting goes into that prison every week and that it's very well attended every fucking week. That this message is being carried, that there are people on this planet that love Narcotics Anonymous. Yeah. Yeah. There are people here that love it. And I'm going to tell you one more quick story. Are you cutting me off? Oh, you can. Oh. Okay. How long am I talking? Listen. One of my home group members a guy who I love very much. I seen him come into my home group 6 years ago. He was using drugs. He got clean in my home group. He became a lover of this fellowship. People called him every fucking thing. They called him controlling. He's a Nazi. He's an NA Nazi. Let me tell you something. Don't call me a fucking NA Nazi. I don't take kindly to that kind of insult. I'll tell you what. I'm a lover of this fellowship, and I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to stay clean and to help another addict get clean. If that's a Nazi, Nazis fucking put people in gas chambers. They didn't pull people out of the depths of despair and offer them love, concern, and fellowship, and fill their hearts with spiritual principles and show them a new way of life. So they called this guy everything. He was a die-hard Narcotics Anonymous member. He got involved in our convention committee. He was on the programming committee. His name is John V. He got involved with the fellowship. In my home group, I seen him touch the hearts of not hundreds, but thousands of addicts. I seen him be a part of the miracle that happens when you're an involved member of a home group here in Narcotics Anonymous. He got involved in the convention, and the convention became his fucking passion, our convention. We had our first convention. He was responsible for inviting most of the speakers to our first convention. The members in New York said that it was the best Narcotics Anonymous convention in about 25 years. At the convention, his feet swelled up. And he found out that he had a cancerous tumor on his liver. He died last week, 1 week ago today, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I just want to talk about him because there are people that this fellowship is so important to that they're willing to give their last few minutes of life so that another addict may live. When I first came to my home group, I have two of them. The one that meets in the day and one meets on Thursday night, Clean Queens group. There were 20 guys there. They're all diagnosed with AIDS. Every one of them died one by one. Not one of those guys never was too busy to take me to a meeting, whether I was high or not, to buy me a basic text, to hug me, to welcome me back. Those guys showed me what this fellowship is all about more than words or the literature or any of the other bullshit that we have here ever could. They instilled in my heart the spiritual essence of a loving fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous. John carried on their legacy. In his last moments of life, he gave something that we have in our home group. He left his fucking footprint in our home group. He showed those newcomers. He only had 5 years clean. Let me tell you something about clean time. I've been coming here for 22 years. I have 9 years and 8 months clean. There's guys that I came here with 22 years ago that act like, you only have 9 years and 8 months clean. Here's what I tell them. I tell them, let the fucking judge tell you 9 years and 8 months. Maybe that'll give you a new perspective on clean time. Really. But he had 5 years clean. In his 5 years, he was like the lives he touched and the people whose lives were affected because of his membership in this fellowship are countless. And here's what I'm going to say to you guys tonight. I challenge you to be the next John in this fellowship. I invite you to partake in the spiritual miracle that we have here. You know, we have members, and then we have fucking members. Let me tell you something. I'm going to say it again. I'm fucking down with this shit. And I want to thank the convention committee for inviting me here. I want to let the newcomers know that I know you're going to be clean before you do. I believe in you guys. If you guys aren't clean yet, I want to tell you this, that I believe in you because I've seen it happen thousands of fucking times. And I want to thank everybody for being welcoming. I'm excited about being here in the Mocan area. Mocan. It's smoking. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.